And now, The Federal Drive with Tom Temin,
sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian. Our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, how artificial intelligence could make fraud against the government worse. Plus, how the Merit Systems Protection Board is plowing through its appeals backlog. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, the General Services Administration is putting the final touches on its solicitation for the big Alliant 3 IT services contract. One section already finished, though, is a new approach to attracting small businesses with new technology. Federal News Network's Jason Miller joins me with what he's learned. And let's start, Jason, with a brief reminder here. What exactly is Alliant 3, and why is there so much excitement about this long-awaited deal from industry?
There is a lot of excitement going across the government contracting sector. And, Tom, obviously, Alliant 3 is the follow-up to, of course, Alliant 2, which has been the government-wide acquisition contract, the GWAC for IT services, that's been around now for pushing probably 15 or 20 years. And I think the reason why there's so much excitement around Alliant 3, which is going to really cover a broad swath of IT services, is because of how well Alliant 2 has done and the popularity among agencies. Now, GSA data shows agencies obligated more than $8.6 billion across 117 task orders in 2023 alone. And in fact, it got so popular that in 2022, back in August of that time, of that year, GSA increased the ceiling of Alliant 2 to $75 billion from $50 billion because it saw just how much the spending trends were going up to that $50 billion ceiling. I did a little bit of quick math, and since GSA awarded Alliant 2 in 2018, agencies have obligated more than $26 billion. Now, of course, Tom, obligation is not the same as spent, but that's a lot of money to be going through this contract. And it has been, in many ways, the go-to contract for many major and high-dollar programs agencies have pursued over the last 3 or 4 years. In fact, the average task order under Alliant 2 is about $120 million. Now, the expectation for Alliant 3 is to be just as popular. There's a lot of spending expected to go through it, and I think a lot of vendors and agencies are following this closely.
All right, and you've been looking at the Alliant 3 provision for promoting small businesses that also have emerging technology. And what is GSA saying there?
As part of the draft solicitation for Alliant 3 that GSA issued last December, there were a lot of details about this new approach really to hold large businesses, or what they call other than small businesses, because they just can't call everybody large for some reason, Tom, accountable for learning about small businesses in specific emerging technology areas. Now, GSA detailed areas such as big data, cloud, cyber, AI, zero trust, quantum computing as some of those 11 areas. And what the Small Business Emerging Technology Solutions engagement requires is for that large business to meet with at least 5 small businesses who work in one of these 11 areas. Now, these 11 emerging technology areas came from GSA's IT category office that has been looking at this and continues to do so. Now, Paul Bowen is the director of the Center for GWAC Programs at GSA. He describes how this evaluation factor will work.
Meet with them. Have them sign a form that, hey, we met, we had an engagement, we spoke, we talked, we got a little mojo going. Have them sign it. They have to provide the proof of, yes, they have the eligible product. And then when Paulco, the other than small business offerer, submits it, I would receive 200 points for each of the 5 engagements up to a total maximum of 1,000 points.
Now, Bowen was speaking at the ACT IAC event last Friday. He says GSA isn't being prescriptive about how these engagements should work or may not come from them.
Now, GSA does not dictate how these meetings are set up, how long they last, the terms of them. It's entirely between for you to all figure out how you want to do it, to come to a terms with each other, whether it's a phone call, whether it's a meeting, whether it's a demonstration, however you work it out. You work it out. There's no expectation that you will have done business in the past, nor does it create an obligation in GSA's eyes that you'll do business together in the future. It's a way to matchmake.
And I think, Tom, this is really important because matchmaking is something that agencies push through these big contracts all the time. So for GSA to be like, hey, you will make this happen with at least five, I think that's a really important thing. GSA did put some parameters on the size of the emerging small businesses. They have to have at least done $100,000 worth of business or be part of the SBIR STTR program. And Tom, real quick, one thing that was brought up at this ACT IAC event on Friday is, how does it work, right? They want the businesses kept asking questions. So let me just try to put a little bit of clarity around this. Large businesses can only get credit for meeting with different small businesses on five engagements. So you can't just meet with the same small business five times and say, well, they do cloud, they do cyber, they do health IT. So you can only go to the same category, again, whether it's cloud, cyber, AI, whatever, more than two times. So that's your limit. And that means you got to meet, if I meet with Tom Temin and Associates, a small business in AI, I can only meet with you for AI, and then I can only meet with XYZ small business on AI, and then I'm done with AI. I got to go to the other areas. And I think that's how you earn your 1,000 points. Now, small businesses who are bidding on Alliant 3 do not have to participate in this way. They automatically receive that 1,000 points. But again, they could be convinced to do it if they want to, but they're already going to receive that 1,000 points as part of their evaluation.
Sounds like a cross between the dating game and concentration or something, the way they're doing it. And why did GSA, or how do they come up with this particular approach? And I have a follow-up question on the CIBR question, but how do they come up with this approach?
I think there's several reasons why GSA has taken this approach. I think the first is it's pretty easy, right? It just makes sense for small businesses to matchmake as part of the evaluation. It just made sense.
We know that small businesses have really been leaders in emerging technology, which is such a focus for everyone, including the government. And for us to have an evaluated factor where other than small business offers on Alliant 3 have a scored element where they can go out and meet with small businesses with emerging technology solutions is a win-win for everyone. It's a win-win for the small businesses with the emerging technology because they have the ability to go meet with these companies where previously it may have been difficult to get in the door. So, and it's a win for the other than small business offers because they get to learn about these technologies and they demonstrate to the government that they have the ability to go out and find small businesses with emerging technology because so much of the emerging technology is being done at, you know, almost the garage level and above at this point.
And again, that's GSA's Paul Bowman. My question, Jason, is if a company is under a CIBR agreement, those often are by other transaction authority, not FAR procurements. Does that interfere with Alliant 3 in any way?
It does not, because what they're doing is just saying, hey, here's a company that it's an actual company using the CIBR, the STTR agreement that you have with the government, just shows that, hey, you're real. You're not just, again, two people in a garage who have never done business with the government. And also there's the CIBR phase one is only, I think, $75,000. So it doesn't meet that $100,000 threshold, that minimum. But it's good enough for the government, so to speak, because they are part of this bigger program and have been shown that they can do some of this work.
Right. It's almost a qualifier.
Exactly. And I think this is really important because, Tom, this is maybe the first time that this type of small business matchmaking has ever been used as an evaluation factor in the procurement. Now, it's not a huge evaluation factor. Alliant 3 may have 30,000 points or some crazy amount. So it's 1,000 points. But I think that push that Bowman's talking about is really giving small businesses some leverage with the larger firms, at least to get meetings and at least to be getting that explanation of what they do and how they do it.
And real quick, Jason, what is the timeline for GSA to release the request for proposals themselves?
So GSA says third quarter of this year. And guess what, Tom? We're in the third quarter of this year. So
I've
any
noticed.
Day now. But really, Bowman said we're looking at really end of May, early June timeframe. And I think the one big change folks should know about Alliant 3 versus Alliant 2 is the number of awards GSA is targeting, about 76 vendors in all. Now, this is a pretty big increase over the 60 awards that GSA made under Alliant 2. Part of the reason why they want to add more is there's been 22 vendors who have left Alliant 2 since 2018, 11 to mergers and acquisitions. And 11 have been, Tom will say, voluntold to leave the contract versus being kicked off because they didn't meet some specific bidding or winning requirements under Alliant 2. So now there's only 38 vendors, and GSA is worried about competition, so more the better.
Federal News Network's Jason Miller, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
And be sure to check out his story at federalnewsnetwork.com. And this program note, for Earth Day, celebrated all week, check out the Energy Strategy Series, a special daily presentation of ideas for transforming the nation's energy infrastructure. Sign up at WTOP.com. Still to come, how the Merit Systems Protection Board is plowing through its appeals backlog. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. The Merit Systems Protection Board has had a quorum now for more than 2 years, and when members were finally approved by the Senate back in 2022, they faced a backlog of some 3,800 appeals cases. The two members the board does have are within spitting distance of eliminating that backlog. For an update on this and a few other matters, we welcome the MSPB Chair, Kathy Harris. Ms. Harris, good to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
And as we speak, it looks like you will have closed in on about 3,000 of those 3,800 appeals cases, working with your compatriot there, Ray Lamone. And so give us the update. And when it looks like you're within, as I said, spitting distance of getting rid of the backlog.
I like when someone refers to my work as involving spitting. I try to be clean, but we are working very hard. As of March 31st, we've decided over 2,500 of the 3,800 cases from our inherited inventory. That's what we call the backlog, which means only about 34% of those cases remained at the end of March. Along the way, we decided about 350 newer cases. So you're right, we're closing in on about 3,000 cases total. We expect to clear that inherited inventory by FY 2025.
That's not that far off at this point. Yeah.
No, it really isn't. You know, I would say sooner, but some of these cases are thorny and hard and, you know, they deserve extra time to figure out. But we're working very hard. And what we're doing is we're doing the oldest cases and the newest cases simultaneously. And the reason is we don't want to create a permanent case update group in our agency that has to update the law and, you know, as the law changes and evolves, we don't want to be in a permanent hole. We're coming in toward the middle. You'll see that we continue to do that. But our pace is, I think, pretty fierce. We're doing great.
So you're doing the oldest and newest. And is there a way of glancing at the case and knowing before you delve into it whether this one's going to be complicated and we should spend some time clearing it? Or can you tell this could be a fairly simple one?
I mean, personally, I think I've gotten better at spotting the issues and seeing, do I need to do more research? Do I need to have staff look into an additional issue? But the lucky thing for Ray Lamone and I is that everything's been prepped for us already. Our Office of Appeals Counsel staff, their lawyers and paralegals, have already spent significant time reviewing the record, reviewing the appeal briefs, and giving us a preview of what we're to expect and drafting a decision for us. So, you know, most of the time I agree with what OAC has done and it's pretty simple and fast. Other times I have questions, maybe I have an edit, maybe the laws changed, things need to be changed. So it really depends. But I think my sniffer has gotten pretty good.
Yeah, we saw one case that was cleared from the inherited backlog where someone, I think, got 10 years of back pay at one of the agencies. So there's some real archaeology going on here. And it must occur to you at times that this is actually someone's life here and not just a academic piece of material we're reading and rendering a judgment on.
Yeah, for me, it's not sometimes, it's always. I realize that, you know, I spent 2 decades representing federal employees and agencies. And I had clients who were waiting for decisions for 5 years. And I saw, I mean, it was destructive to their lives to have to wait so long for a resolution. And it's destructive to the efficiency of the agencies to have to wait so long for resolutions. So every day, you know, I sit down and I'm doing these cases and I understand people have been waiting and they deserve justice. They deserve a response. It's not fair to them. So that's why we work so hard.
We're speaking with Kathy Harris, chairman of the Merit Systems Protection Board, and of the inherited cases. Has much of it been precedential? Because that means it's really important and new ground is being broken in this field. and therefore, you know, it's important that the precedential cases, you know, get resolved.
About 2% of our inherited inventory cases have been precedential. That's a pretty low number. I think that's because we have a very good body of law that's developed at the MSPB since 1980 or so, when the board started issuing decisions. And, you know, there are new issues that come up. There are issues that we think deserve to be reexamined based on new law, new statutes, new precedent from our reviewing courts, which is typically the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, or just changes in circumstances. And I think that's a good thing that it's relatively low. It means, I think, that the board had been doing a pretty good job of laying out its precedent in the past.
Sure. And in looking at a large number of the older cases sort of all at once or in this telescope fashion, can you also evaluate maybe the judges that have made the initial decision that's being appealed and maybe, golly, we overturn 50% of this person, but we only overturn, you know, 1% of that person. What's going on within the staff judges?
I try not to pay attention to which judge I'm reviewing because I'm really focused on the legal aspects of the case and the facts, not the particular judge. I'll say that our judges are fabulous. Most of the time, their decisions get sustained. They got it right. And when they don't get it right, sometimes it has nothing to do with their legal acumen. It has to do with the fact that so much time has passed that the law changed in the meantime, and they didn't have the benefit of new statutes that are retroactive or a new law that came down from the federal circuit. So one of the trends we're seeing is a bunch of remands and, for instance, performance cases, Chapter 43 performance cases, because the federal circuit changed the law on that as it went down. So we had to remand those cases. Or the VA had come up with a new system to adjudicate some of their cases, which we called 714 after the section of the law. 714 cases had to be remanded, many of them, because of developments at the federal circuit. The other big trend I'm seeing is remanding whistleblower cases, where we took a too narrow view of the jurisdictional standard, and Congress stepped in and said, you know, that's no, we intend it more broadly, and the courts agreed. So those are the kinds of things, you know, overall that we see in terms of trends of remands and reversals.
And by the way, what is the percentage of reversals? That's not all that high either, is it?
It's pretty low. I don't have the exact number, but it's not very high. We do track it. I just don't have it in front of me.
Okay. And, you know, not long ago, a month or so ago, month and a half, you were finally confirmed as chair after being acting chair for a year or so, I guess it was, or a couple of years. And did that make any practical difference in your daily life there?
I mean, I think it makes a difference to the agency as a whole and our stakeholders. I think it's important for the agency's legitimacy and stability. Congress cares about us. We see that. You know, they care enough to staff us with a permanent head. I'm the first confirmed chair at the agency since 2017, so it's been some time. In terms of very small practical differences, I get a little raise, so that's exciting. But other than that, my duties are the same, my responsibilities are the same, and I don't think anybody thinks I'm any more important than I was, you know, a couple months ago.
Because as a confirmed chair, there's no major policy changes that you really have the ability or the power to make, fair to say?
I have the same powers as acting chair as I have as chairman. And most of our decisions that we make that have significance are done by the members. So Ray Lamone, my vice chair, and I both agree on certain things that will have significance to the board.
And I suppose for the judges, these are administrative judges, and you've got some administrative law judges too, I think, within the confines of the MSPB. It must be good for their morale, maybe, or sense of belonging in an agency when Congress did take the time to confirm a chair and not just go with acting indefinitely.
I hope so. I mean, I think it's good. I hope the staff thinks it's good. I hope they are happy to have me continue in leadership. I'm certainly honored. I think I'm working with the very best group of federal employees that there are. We're all very mission focused, and we have a very important mission. Happen to be extremely smart and brainy group of individuals. I just feel so lucky to be able to work with them, and I'm happy. It's a great job. We have administrative judges on our staff. You mentioned administrative law judges. We do have some on a contract basis at the board. There are some differences between administrative judges and ALJs in terms of classification, statutory authority, reporting structure, and the types of matters they hear. The ALJs are required to hear certain types of cases at the board assigned to them by statute. Those are handled differently from how MSPB AJs hear cases, special regulations, procedures, and specific case law. But beyond that, these are very technical issues that we would have to have a lot more time to discuss.
And so would you like your legacy to be, when your term is up, I got rid of the inherited inventory?
Yes, we are going to get rid of the inherited inventory. It's going to be soon, and we're going to have a big party.
Kathy Harris is chairman of the Merit Systems Protection Board. As always, great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive, together with a link to the latest information on that, not backlog, but inherited inventory. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, it's April, but end of termism will start to slow federal contracting. But first, how artificial intelligence will make fraud against the government even worse. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Federal investigators have their hands full trying to spot all of the fraud schemes that cost the government billions every year. Imagine artificial intelligence-powered fraud and its potential for mischief. For more on that potential and how to stop it, Federal News Network's Eric White spoke to the vice president and head of public sector strategy at Socure, Jordan Burris.
In recent years, what we've effectively seen is the continued rise in prevalence of sophisticated attacks to what would be our nation's, you know, identity infrastructure in particular, right? And so, you know, I recognize that a lot of the actions by the administration or even those of Congress are those that they've been talking about for quite a bit of time. And I'm, for one, glad to see them starting to take action in this space.
What are some of these schemes, I guess, that are AI powered? Is there, you know, any human engineering involved whatsoever? Or, you know, is it just a lot of code just going after other lines of code?
Right. So I would love to say that we were at a place where it's like the Terminator and AI is just thinking for itself. But generally, these are things that have been put into motion based on the actions of individuals at the end of the day. Right. So what we're seeing is that, you know, AI is being used at scale to think about it, to accelerate activities that otherwise would be once manual and tedious. This could be everything from generating fake personas and identities to creating what would be images that allow for impersonation. In particular, this could be, you know, taking and finding ways to scramble, create PII and submit those on websites in order to intercept government benefits, for an example, especially those who are using weaker controls. In particular, and so think of it as more of a tool. And unfortunately, when it comes to, you know, nation state actors or the criminal organizations, they're using this now more than ever to scale what they had been doing historically.
Yeah. Is this a system failure or is there some human error involved as well? Because, you know, personally, I can usually tell when I'm not talking to a real person.
You know, it's always very interesting. And so when we made the decision as a society to kind of embrace digital as a, you know, predominant channel for interacting, right? And we did this as consumers in particular, right? Because it was easier, it was more seamless for us. We kind of did away with some of that interaction that used to take place in person, all right? So you would always have to show up either at your bank, or go and engage with some of your local grocery store, even in some cases, to participate in good and service. It was no different in government in particular. Now, I, for one, am not advocating to say that, hey, let's go back to things being very manual, because I would never actually get anything done. I'm absolutely terrible in some cases running errands around my house. But when we did away with that, we kind of still relied on some of those processes as they had been constructed at that moment in time, right? This reliance on whether it be government issued documents as they've been provided, the reliance on, you know, holding on to things such as our social security numbers and pretending that for some reason they've never been compromised or revealed in a data breach in some way, shape, or form, and other elements of our PII. And as such, a lot of the, we'll say, preventative measures that have been put in place historically have not evolved, right? And that has left us more susceptible. Now, I always hate to go back and look at the pandemic as a thing, but as a turning point or a turning moment for what happens with the digital ecosystem, that is kind of where you saw a lot of these controls start to break down or became more prevalent and understood the challenge that was going to be had, right? And this is what's led to billions of dollars in fraud today across a number of sectors, to include that of the public sector as well.
We're speaking with Jordan Burris. He is the head of public sector strategy for SoCure. And so let's talk controls. What can be done to stop these new schemes that are popping up? Is it going to require an evolution of those controls that are already in place, or is some new technology going to have to be implemented?
So first and foremost, I think there's like a mindset shift that is required when it comes to this conversation, right? A lot of what the government has done or others have done is take a, I'm going to say, a pay and chase approach to this problem, right? Because the thought was always that, hey, if we, you know, got the funds out quickly, or if we, you know, made sure that the users on the other end of the screen ultimately got their benefit, in the event we got it wrong in any way, shape, or form, right, that we could claw that money back. Well, that continues to prove out over time. It's not easy to get this money back. Actually, a number, larger amounts of funding that have been issued to individuals, you know, the government regular reports on how, you know, even though they're increasing what would be law enforcement activities in order to recover it, they're only able to get but a fraction back of those funds. And so with shifting that mindset to away from pay and chase, then it's about taking preventative measures to see what we can do up front. Now, part of the discussion has been, if we layer in too much security and we do too many things up front, unfortunately, we are going to put undue burden on the public when it comes to interacting and engaging with any digital system, right? How many times do you really want to be asked to take a picture of your driver's license in order to prove who you are, right? Or to take some other type of step, or to show up in person, or have a phone call into a call center, right? That becomes too burdensome. The reality is, it doesn't even have to be that way, right? I would say that's even some in cases a legacy mindset shift that's taken place, no different than when we were talking about migrating technology platforms from being on-premise and moving them to the cloud. We actually had to rethink what it meant to restructure our technology solutions. We have to rethink what prevention may mean at scale, and how you can actually be able to assess the risk of an individual doing so passively and only introducing some of these more burdensome checks or friction points when absolutely necessary to validating who they are, right? And so that becomes kind of the new discipline, the new art, if you will, that comes with, you know, being able to prove out individuals' identities. And it's something that, you know, much of what the administration is, you know, starting to call for is understanding we need to be taking some of these more preventative measures right out of the gate.
Yeah, I can only identify the pictures with bicycles in them so many times, Jordan, that after a while I get a little flustered. You know, and also it's a zero-sum game for the hackers themselves now, right? Because these tools have made it not only cheaper, but as you mentioned, less costly in time. So even if they're only able to get a fraction of what they take in a ransomware scheme or something like that, it's all profit, right?
Absolutely. And the interesting piece about them is that they're, of course, using it to funnel back into their criminal enterprises in order to continue to scale their offerings in particular, right? And note, they're not doing this alone. They're sharing insights with each other, right? They're discussing what happens and how certain solutions, systems, services that are being delivered, how they're porous and effectively how you each every single person who wants to partake in that type of scheme can actually engage with it in order to intercept benefits in particular, right? So they're highly networked. They're getting more and more sophisticated over time. To your point, the cost is going down in their ability to execute these attacks. And so more so now than ever, we need to be thinking about what could we be layering upfront in order to basically fight back, right? Fight back with the same tools that are being used to circumvent our existing online services.
Jordan Burris is Vice President and Head of Public Sector Strategy at Socure, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. Find this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive and subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, it's April, but end of termism will start to slow federal contracting. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. As they do every 4 years at this time, political appointees begin to depart. In their absence, contractors should prepare for a slowdown in new and innovative project starts. At least that's the view of longtime federal and marketing and sales consultant Larry Allen, who joins me now. And this phenomenon is real, isn't it? The end of term, even if the same guy could get elected, the political start to leave in general now, don't they?
That's right, Tom. They really do. And it's inevitable. It really doesn't depend on who's in the White House. Like clockwork, this time of a four-year presidential term, whether it's the first or second term, you see appointees starting to leave, either to go back to the private sector. Some may join the campaign and try to reshuffle the deck. If their candidate gets reelected, they can come back in, perhaps in a different spot. But in the meantime, while you certainly have very competent career managers in government agencies, inevitably, the pace of change, particularly for innovative projects, drops at least one gear. And we're starting to see that a little bit right now. It's not that the meat and potatoes of government work won't get done. That still gets done right now, and thankfully will get done through the end of the fiscal year. But if you're trying to do anything that is closely tied to an administration priority, and then all of a sudden the top one or two people in that agency appointed by the administration leave, well, you know, that could create a question mark.
A lot of agencies, I think, are still evaluating the possibility of TMF funds, of Technology Modernization Fund dollars. And that takes some high-level sponsorship in general, doesn't it?
It does. And you've seen a lot of scrutiny paid to the TMF. And I'm a big supporter of that fund, by the way, Tom. I think that it's something that, used correctly, gives government the ability to break out of its "this is how we've always done it" mode and get into something new. But it does take that top level leadership. It also takes increasingly accountability at the top level for how those funds are spent and the ability to repay at least part of them back to the fund. We know that that's been a major area of congressional oversight of the TMF over the last couple of years. And so if you don't have that, then I think the people who make those decisions on how TMF dollars are allocated will notice that.
And given the fact that appropriations for 2024 didn't get to agencies until halfway through the fiscal year in the first place, maybe the whole slowdown issue is a little compounded. You have the slowing down because of the end of the administration, and you also have the slowness to ramp up because of the lateness of the funds. What's the best course for contractors to keep some action going here?
Tom, I think that's a great question. And if I were advising companies, I would say, while you don't want to totally dismiss those innovative programs that people have been talking about, you might want to take a little more of a cautious approach to some of them, particularly if you know that the leadership in those agencies has been leaving. But there still is money to be spent, as you pointed out. So if it's not going to be spent on those innovative things, it's going to be spent anyway on state of the market, keep everything going, maybe update the programs we already have in place, those sort of expenditures. And if you're a contractor, you should recalibrate your approach to business accordingly.
We're speaking with Larry Allen, president of Allen Federal Business Partners. You're also writing this week that the Small Business Innovation Research, SBIR, acquisitions are accelerating, and they've been growing fast in the last couple of years. Review quickly what they are and what types of contractors ought to maybe get in on that action.
Well, Tom, what we're talking about here is the Small Business Innovation Research Program, SBIR, SBIR in the parlance, because everybody's got to have an acronym in government acquisition. And looking at federal procurement data system spend information, SBIR contracts have gone up 31% over the last 4 years. That's a substantial increase. And what these are, they're really intended to be prototype development sort of programs, similar in some ways to other transaction authority, although with their own special rules and regulations. It's not supposed to be things that are in current commercial production until you at least get to phase three of the SBIR. There are three phases. And, you know, the first phase is the proof of the technology. The second would be the prototyping. And the third would be fuller on-time online production before you transition to a regular commercial item acquisition strategy. In terms of the businesses, even though SBIR, small business, is right there in the name, I really think that the SBIR program is starting to get interest from contractors of all sizes. While large business can't really prime a small business contract by definition, that doesn't mean that large businesses haven't taken note of growth in the SBIR arena. It's simply becoming another way to conduct non-traditional acquisitions to try to get around some of the red tape and an increasing amount of red tape that governs a lot of government buys these days. So for that reason, it's gaining a lot of popularity. And so if you're a large business, I think, you know, you ought to talk to some small business teammates about this as one of the arrows in your acquisition quiver.
Yes, if you look at SBIR and OTA, as you mentioned earlier, it seems like water is seeking its own level and trying to get some kind of efficient way to get these types of contracts done that is extra far, you might say.
I think that's a really good way to look at it, Tom. And, you know, the idea that you've got all these workarounds, you know, it's like heart bypass surgery. You know, the regular arteries are clogged, but the heart still needs to keep beating. It's the same thing here. You've got a government acquisition system where the traditional lanes are maybe a little jammed up, so people keep looking for ways around, and SBIR is definitely one of those conduits.
And then there is the issue in the far world of increasing demand for data by federal agencies about acquisition, about contractors, about contractor activity, and it's getting burdensome.
It really is. The demand for data in government acquisition is insatiable, and I think there are some clear benefits to the government for data-driven acquisition decisions. However, increasingly, it's industry that is being asked or required to come up with the data and to provide it in a way that's usable to government agencies. That just increases contractor overhead. And what I'm saying here is that it's time for contractors to have an honest discussion with their government counterparts on the need, their need for data, their desire for it, but the fact that, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And if the government wants all this information, then contractors are going to have to be compensated to pay for it, because, as I said, it's not like government traditionally turns to contracting officers and says, gather this data. Or if they do, then the contracting officers in turn go to industry and say, gather this data. So it really drives up acquisition overhead and record-keeping burdens for contractors. And if that's something that the government wants, okay, but we have to have a discussion about who's going to pay for it.
Larry Allen is president of Allen Federal Business Partners. As always, thanks so much.
Tom, thank you, and I wish your listeners happy selling.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. And this program note, be sure to sign up for Federal News Network's Customer Experience Exchange, starting today at 1. The online event will feature an array of Federal CX success stories. Today's speakers include Social Security Commissioner Martin O'Malley and the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency's Mark Peckrell. The CX Exchange, today at 1. Sign up at federalnewsnetwork.com. It's been a year since the Biden administration first called for agencies to ramp up in-person work back to the office. Well, now, after coming back to their offices, Many feds, those that did, are asking, why are we here? Well, we asked too, and our Federal News Network survey found that more than half of feds don't think their agency leadership has really explained the return to office rationale. Federal News Network's Drew Friedman joins me now with more of those survey results. And let's begin with some of the stats here. Drew, how many responses did we get?
Tom, we received more than 6,300 responses on this survey. That is huge. It's almost 2,000 more than any survey that Federal News Network has conducted. And I would say before we even get into the survey results, just that sheer number of responses tells you how important of a subject this is to federal employees, whether or not you agree with returning to the office, whether or not you agree that you want to be teleworking or whether you want to be in person. It's a huge topic, and it's been that way for several years now.
Yeah, it's the biggest thing since pay and benefits. I guess maybe it's a benefit. And based on the survey results, 6,300, wow. What are some of the common concerns about the return to the office?
Some of the common points that a lot of federal employees in the survey brought up, they talked about their ability to focus. I think that was a big one. So they said distractions or disruptions from coworkers, or exhaustion from the commute, trying to get to and from the office every day. Those all contribute negatively or adversely to their productivity. They find, as you said, they don't really understand why they're in the office. A lot of agencies have pointed to stronger collaboration, productivity, efficiency, better work culture, all of these factors that go into why federal employees are coming back to the office. But it's either feds don't believe those are the reasons, or they disagree that those are really specific to being in the office. We found that from the survey results, 2/3 of respondents felt they were less productive in the office, and a lot of them believed that senior leadership isn't really explaining in enough rationale for why
right.
they're there. Yeah.
We just want you here because Jeff Zients said to be here because the White House told him to say you need to be here. And mm-hmm. the annoyance with the other colleagues and the distractions. I mean, let's face it, when you're home, nobody is having anchovy pizza, you know, when the anchovies were soaked in garlic oil or something. And one of the big issues of the federal, any office space, I guess. And we know that some of the agencies want to encourage their offices as collaboration spaces. You can rent spaces to get together, reserve spaces, I should say. What about that? Does that go over pretty well?
Not exactly. I think, well, just to point out what agencies are trying to do, a lot of them have introduced what they call core collaboration days, which is, in so many words, it's government speak for, you know, we're going to bring employees in person on the same day at the same time and set up meetings or specific activities that foster collaboration or are meaningful in-person work. A lot of federal employees in the survey said they were a bit neutral, I suppose, on whether or not those were beneficial to their productivity. About half said that they don't really affect their like work-related tasks or their interpersonal relationships with coworkers, and to some extent had a negative impact on both productivity and just overall office morale.
Yeah, my theory on that is that there are times when formal collaboration has to happen. Say, let's do our strategic plan for the year or something, and everyone's prepared in advance, and you go and do your strategic collaborating. Then there are those infinite number of last minute, spur of the moment, oh, I see that person, let me collaborate type of thing. That doesn't happen at all when everyone's teleworking, or maybe it happens and you reach them by some sort of communications means, Slack or whatever the case might be. Not quite the same thing. So the idea of everyone coming in at a given day seems forced because, oh, here, let's collaborate because we're all here. There may be nothing to collaborate about at that moment. But the next morning at 10:30, when everyone's back at home, that's when the need arises. So that could be the answer to why that answer came up so much in the survey.
No, that I think that you pretty much nailed it, Tom. There, you know, a lot of respondents to the survey said that, you know, it should be up to them to decide when and where that collaboration is needed. And they said a lot of the times those meetings don't really have to be in person. They can be, like you said, over Slack, Zoom, Teams, whatever means you have it. And they said, you know, the workplace is shifting, it's adapting, and they don't really understand, or a lot of people don't understand why they're going back to the office more often.
And we have been covering agency by agency the specific policies. And for some agencies, a lot of the bigger agencies, there's a minimum number of days that you have to be there. And it's not even five. It might be four or so out of the pay period, which is 2 to 3 days per work. But sounds like even that's not going over very well.
It really depends on the agency. Yes, it is going to be about 50% of your work hours spent in the office for those who have initiated those return to office plans. I think what federal employees in this survey are getting at, more so than how many days or the number of days in the office that they're spending, it's more a question of just they want more flexibility. They want to be able to decide when they're going to the office and how much, and to only go in when it makes sense rather than being told, hey, you have to be in every Wednesday, for example.
And one of the things that the survey showed is that people are having maybe negative views of agency leadership over this issue, because leadership, management, SES, and the political appointees are kind of obligated to carry out what the White House wants, or at least try to.
Yes, some of the survey questions that we did for the survey were looking at how return to office plans affected views of immediate supervisors, senior leaders, and then overall agency. It's clear that a lot of federal employees, not super surprisingly, place more of the blame or the onus on the return to office plans on senior leadership. And we had 47% of respondents said that they now feel more negatively towards senior leaders as a result of return to office changes, and about similar results for just their views of the agency overall. So this is having a more long-term impact on federal employees and how they're seeing their day-to-day work.
And as you know, and as we were covering for 15 years prior to this, telework was not a birth effect of the pandemic. There was telework policy, there were telework debates, telework bills. Some agencies had gone fully to telework or extensively to telework because they had a scattered workforce. PTO was the brainchild of that for so many years. So has there been a shift in telework because of the pandemic? I mean, what did that change? If nothing, then get everyone to mass telework, and everyone got a taste of it.
No, it's a really good question. Telework has been around, as you said. It's well predates the pandemic. And I think one big takeaway from the survey was federal employees, a majority of them feel like telework is beneficial and productive, and they don't really understand why you would want to shift back to what they had before the pandemic if they feel like, you know, this was a lesson we learned during the pandemic, even though, of course, there was a lot of negative news and things that came from the pandemic. One positive was understanding the importance of hybrid work and having that flexibility. And I think you just have a lot of federal employees who feel happy with those changes and they want to stick with them.
Well, productivity is a hard thing to measure in this type of, let's say, for lack of a better word, white-collar workforce. And a person might think they're more productive, but that's not necessarily the case.
No, that's a great question as well. A lot of agencies have different ways to measure productivity. Some, it's easier. You can look at the number of documents that were completed or whatever you want to say, like a number of cases that were resolved. There some number involved, but a lot of federal employees have work where you can't really measure that in a number. And that is a question that definitely has come up in Congress, in the White House, and I think will continue to come up for a long time.
Federal News Network's Drew Friedman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And be sure to check out her survey story. It was her survey at federalnewsnetwork.com. And this program note, for Earth Day celebrated all week, check out the Energy Strategy Series, a special daily presentation of ideas for transforming the nation's energy infrastructure. Sign up at WTOP.com. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm Tom Temin.